Our fourth case for argument this morning is Cadleway Properties against ASEAN State Bank. Mr. Serban.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dan Serban. I'm here representing the appellant, Cadleway Properties, Inc. Cadleway is in the business of...
Into the merits of this appeal, I have more than a few questions about appellate jurisdiction. First question is, what is the relation between this dispute and the disputes remaining in the district court? Our circuit rule 28A3 requires that information to be in the briefs. It's not in your brief. It's not in the appellee's briefs, but we need it. So what is that relation?
What the relation is this case was originally removed from...
How it got here. What is the relation between this case and those that remain in the district court?
The issues that remain, this is really the main issue remaining. This is the
only... Stop with the characterizations and just tell me the facts.
Okay. The facts of this case are...
No, you're not getting it. I need to know the relation between this dispute and what is pending in the district court. The caption in the district court has a dozen parties. The reason it's in the district court is because the federal government removed it. Are all those disputes resolved?
Those disputes are resolved.
They're all resolved. Were they resolved before you filed your appeal?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
So why did the district court enter a Rule 54B judgment?
The district court felt that it was...
Well, you asked. He didn't do it sua sponte. He did it in response to a request. And presumably the reason for the request was there were other things pending in this litigation in the district court.
There is this particular... Let me just step back.
Well, let me ask you, after this case is resolved, is Mr. Magley going to pay some money to somebody? Is he still defending something?
The real issue of this is Mr. Magley has reached an agreement with ASEAN State Bank to pay them money based upon the guarantee that we are discussing today. We feel, Cadleway Properties feels, that it is entitled to be paid money.
So there's still a live dispute in the district court between Mr. Magley and you, for example?
Yes, he is a party to this appeal. And in fact, he filed a motion to basically...
What you've just said in response to Judge Wood, if it's true, shows that there's no appellate jurisdiction. Because you can't argue about a guarantee until the validity of the underlying obligation is established. This is secondary liability. This, by the way, is the very reason why Circuit Rule 28A3 requires what it does. I mean, it's well established that a district court cannot send the secondary litigation forward while the primary litigation is pending.
Well, there has been a determination on the underlying liability. The court has determined and has...
Final judgment been entered on that?
Summary judgment was entered
in... Has a final judgment been entered on that question?
No.
Has a final judgment been entered with respect to the federal government's liability as guarantor?
Summary judgment has been granted, but not final judgment.
No final judgment. Has any part of the litigation finally been resolved?
The only final judgment in this case is the one that we're appealing today.
All right. It is plain we have serious problems with appellate jurisdiction here. So I would like both sides to file within 10 days supplemental memoranda addressing appellate jurisdiction and particularly furnishing the information that was required by Circuit Rule 28A3. You should at the same time explain why you should not be sanctioned for noncompliance with Circuit Rule 28A3. This should be quite unnecessary. We need to know all the details about what is pending, and of course, this will be your time to cite authority about whether this was a proper use of Rule 54B. This memorandum should also address the question whether there is subject matter jurisdiction in this case. I don't understand, for example, why the federal government's removal should lead to the resolution of all the state law claims in a suit in which there is no diversity. 28 U.S.C. 1441C provides for remand of the state law claims when there was a single-party removal like this. And the federal government may be entitled to have its liability resolved in federal court. It's not at all clear to me that anybody else is entitled to have the federal court rule on their liability in this case. By the way, the jurisdictional statements are also non-compliant with the provisions for statement of the details about diversity, and your supplemental jurisdictional statement should cover that as well. We need to know not simply the jurisdictional details about the two people who are contesting this appeal, but all the parties to the litigation. There are lots of parties to this litigation other than the two of you, and you can't just ignore everybody else. It turns out, it seems, that some of these parties are rather complex entities, such as limited liability companies. We need to know all the details about their citizenship to see if there's an independent basis of federal jurisdiction.
We will do so.
10 days.
Thank you. Cableway Properties is in the business of buying, collecting, and at times reselling loans. It buys commercial debt, in this case, bought a substantial amount of commercial debt from Bank One with regard to an individual by the name of Richard Magley and companies that he, businesses that he owned. In part of its collection process, it sold some of these Magley, and I'll refer to these as the Magley debts, sold a substantial portion of the Magley debts to Ossian State Bank, who already had a prior mortgage relationship with Mr. Magley and his businesses. This was done pursuant to an agreement to sell loans, which was dated December 30, 2003.
Forgive me for interrupting, but is there any evidence in the record of mutual mistake in the February 19, 2004 transaction between Cableway and Ossian? In other words, I assume that Cableway didn't know it was giving up the May 18, 2001 guarantee, but is there any evidence that Ossian didn't intend to purchase it?
There's really no evidence as to what either party thought. All we can look at is the documents and the four corners of those documents. And that's basically our argument, is we need to look at all of the documents, the December 30, 2003 agreement to sell loans, as well as the February 19, 2004 assignment of mortgage.
But the problem is, once you look at all of those documents, there's not a specific word anywhere about Magley's guarantee. And that, because of the dragnet clause and so on, takes you back to the idea that it passed along with everything else. The fact that there's a long list of other things that passed is interesting, but Indiana requires specificity, and you're saying specificity equals implication, which I don't think quite works.
Well, you see, specificity is what's in the December 30, 2003 document. It specifically lists four promissory notes.
I know what it lists, but it doesn't mean that it has, that these other things don't move. There's nothing that excludes. There's nothing that talks out loud about this guarantee.
Well, and I think that's exactly my point, is there's nothing in the agreement to sell loans that specifically says, yes, this guarantee.
There's a requirement for such a...
Yeah. The district court located that obligation in the dragnet clause and remarked that it was perplexed that you had not discussed the dragnet clause. And I must say, I'm equally perplexed that having had the case decided on the basis of the dragnet clause, you chose not to mention it on appeal. You know, in normal life, that means you forfeited the argument.
I do believe it is mentioned, Your Honor, and we refer to the Money Store versus Summers case, where basically what it is saying, and that is a very different case, the situation there is it was the use of an attempted use of a dragnet clause between parties who had not contracted with each other. What you had was a judgment creditor who was trying to leapfrog a prior mortgage holder. What we're looking at here is two parties that came together and had an agreement, wrote an agreement to sell loans, which specifically said, here is what we're selling. Doesn't say that we're also might sell some other things that aren't mentioned here. It says we are selling these specific documents. And I think that's what we really need to look at, is the whole transaction and all of the documents. If you look at them as a whole, otherwise you're saying that you don't have to list all the documents in an agreement. You can list many documents, but you don't have to list them all. And I think that's what the real issue is in this case. I will retain any other time that I might have for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Servin. Mr. Grog.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to first begin by addressing Judge Rovner's...
Let's begin with jurisdiction. What are your views on the jurisdictional issues?
My views are, Your Honor, that many of the underlying issues in this case have been resolved. There were various loans, various securities, various cross-collateral agreements, and they secured two specific pieces of property, both of which were owned by Mr. Magley or his various entities. In the lower court, there was an agreement between the parties with regard to one such property. That agreement led to an agreed partial judgment, which was entered by the court on June 10th of 2005. And I believe the judge issued final judgment on that on June 15th, 2005. Then with regard to that property, there was a notice of martial sale, and the property actually did go to martial sale on August 23rd, 2005.
I'm perplexed by your usage of the term final judgment. Final judgment is something that resolves the litigation. Finally resolving a single issue in the litigation or the status of a single piece of property is not a final decision.
I apologize for my misuse of the term.
It's a vital term. It's what this all turns on.
I believe what it was is that the district judge approved the judgment and the agreed judgment that was executed by the parties on June 15th.
Have there been other Rule 54B partial final judgments entered?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, no.
And what is your view of the current status of the Small Business Administration?
I believe that all issues with regard to the Small Business Administration have been resolved by way of settlement. I believe both properties that were the security for any security documents at issue in this case have been sold, one through martial sale and one through a private sale.
Discussion in the district court then of the effect not only of 1441C but also of 1367C 2 and 3?
To the best of my knowledge and my review of the record, there was no such discussion.
Could you clarify?
When state law claims predominate over the federal claim, which is, I think, a fair description of this, the case is supposed to be remanded. But, of course, 1441C says that independent state law claims should be remanded. And the premise of this appeal is that this state law claim is independent of everything else. So to say that this is appealable independently is to say that it should have been remanded under 1441C. We shouldn't be here at all. I mean, I hope you understand what the problem is so that we will get a good discussion in this memo, not only of appellate jurisdiction, but of the relation between the premise of appellate jurisdiction, if there is any, and whether the district court should have resolved this issue in the first place.
I understand.
Okay.
Now, could you clarify something for me?
Yes.
Thanks. Your brief describes the disputed obligation as an April 1st, 2001 guarantee. Cadleway seems to describe it as a May 18th, 2001 promissory note and mortgage, are we all talking about the same thing?
We are, Your Honor, and the dispute there, or the reason that there's a discrepancy there is in the way that the evidence was submitted to the district court. The evidence was submitted, the promissory note is April 1st of 2001, uh-huh. and the final two pages that were attached with that April 2001 promissory note is the guarantee that's at issue here, and the date of that guarantee actually is May 18th of 2001. So the guarantee itself was not executed until a month and a half after the promissory note.
Okay. So that was the Thanks date. A lot.
Okay, speaking to your previous question about whether the parties intended to purchase the guarantee, what you have here is a dragnet mortgage, a mortgage that secures obligations of any and all parties, or obligations between these two parties, any and all of those obligations. Now, when a subsequent creditor, such as Austin State Bank here, comes in and purchases this assignment and purchases the mortgage, they want to be assured.
You can't purchase a mortgage. You can only purchase a note. The mortgage is security for the note. And that's the puzzle for me. The district court and both of your briefs write as if a mortgage were the same thing as a note, as something you could purchase. It's not clear to me why a dragnet clause means anything more than this security is available for all subsequent loans by the same borrower. It doesn't imply, at least as written, it doesn't imply that they all have to be owned by the same person. But the thing that's sold is the note, not the mortgage.
Exactly. But the mortgage can be assigned. You can freely assign the mortgage, and that's what's happened here, coinciding with each purchase of the notes. And the language used in the mortgages in the dragnet provision sets forth that that mortgage secures for the mortgage holder any and all obligations of Mr. Magley.
Yeah.
Past, present, future, otherwise.
So a given piece of property, suppose I have there's a note secured by a mortgage on the Sears Tower, right? And the owner of the Sears Tower issues a second note for a second loan. Mm-hmm. And the Sears Tower secures that too. Why does that imply that the same person must own both obligations?
In order for that obligation to be secured by the mortgage, the dragnet provision in that mortgage, the language of the mortgage says this mortgage is going to be secured by any and all obligations of Mr. Magley owed to the bank.
Secured by obligations. Mortgages secure other obligations.
Exactly. And I apologize for misspeaking again. But
that's the problem. Both of you are continuing to talk as if the mortgage were a note, which it isn't. It's not an obligation.
The mortgage itself is not an obligation. But the guarantee here, which arose 2 years later, is the obligation, which, because of the dragnet language in the mortgage, the piece of property referred to in the mortgage acts as security for the subsequent obligation by way of the guarantee.
Well, take my Sears Tower example. The Sears Tower is serving as security now for two loans, and there's a dragnet clause in the mortgage on the first loan which says the Sears Tower will serve as security for any other loans by the same borrower, to the same borrower. Does that mean, as a matter of state law, that the same person, the same creditor, is entitled to the payments on both notes?
It definitely does, especially now that the Supreme Court has enlightened us through their opinion in the Money Store case, where you have to look at the language of the parties in executing the mortgage.
But now I'm completely lost, right? The first loan is made by the Bank of America. The second loan is made by J.P. Morgan. They're for $10 million each. And your argument is that if there's a dragnet clause in the Bank of America mortgage, the debtor on these notes now must make all payments to Bank of America, must pay $20 million to Bank of America.
No, because the language of the mortgage reveals that the intent of the party is that the mortgage acts as security only for, or the property referred to in the mortgage acts as security only for obligations between those two parties, be it past, present, future, otherwise. So any obligations owned to any other third party or anybody that is not the holder of the mortgage, those obligations are not covered under the mortgage.
Mortgage. Nor can you write a mortgage which says the residual value of this security can't be used for some other loan. All right, Sears Tower is worth $200 million. you pledge $10 million of its value to Bank A, right? And it's something with a dragnet clause, which says if Bank A makes any more loans, the Sears Tower secures them too. But your argument seems to be that at that point, either all money that the owner owes to anybody has to be paid to Bank A, or the Sears Tower is now unavailable as security to Bank B, even though there is $190 million in equity remaining. That can't be right either.
Well, the argument would be that we're secured up to the obligation that is owed to that party, the party that holds the mortgage. And that is a first priority security. Holds the note and is secured by the mortgage.
Exactly.
And that is...
But it doesn't tell you anything about who owns the note. That's what's getting me here.
So under the terms of the mortgage, the parties have to look at what the obligations are. The mortgage says, you know, it's open-ended. It's extremely broad, and it says any and all obligations or liabilities. So what you have to look at is what obligations and liabilities are owed.
My hypothetical owner of the Sears Tower borrows another $10 million from the Bank of America. The Sears Tower secures that, too. But it still doesn't mean that all the money owed to J.P. Morgan has to be paid to the Bank of America.
Only those amounts that constitute obligations between the mortgage holder, the original mortgage holder with the dragnet clause in it, and the Sears Tower, or the debtor.
Mm-hmm.
See, my time has expired.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Serban, your time expired, but because we took up so much time on jurisdiction, I'll give you 2 minutes if you have any rebuttal directed to the merits.
Now, the key, again, I believe, is, as Indiana law requires, we must look at the intent of the parties. The intent of the parties as determined by all of the documents involved. We don't look just at the agreement to sell loans. We don't look just at the assignment of mortgage. We look to reconcile those documents, put those all into one. It just seems incredible to me that what we're doing here, what we would be doing here to take Ossian's position is simply say, we're going to look at the documents and look at the face of those documents, look at what the documents say are being transferred. 4 specific promissory notes, 12 security documents which are securing those promissory notes. We have an assignment which makes a public record and notice to all other parties that the one mortgage, which is part of those security documents, is being assigned from Cadle Way to Ossian. And then simply say, well, there's 3 other documents, in particular the guarantee that we're talking about today. Well, that one gets added in too, even though it's not specifically mentioned anywhere. I believe that is not showing the intent of the parties. The intent of the parties was to sell 16 specific documents, and as a result, I would ask that the court reverse the or entry of summary judgment that was entered by the district court in favor of Ossian State Bank and remand it to the court to enter judgment in favor of Cadle Way Properties. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.